Come to order. It is 1:42 on Monday, February 12th. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum here. Senator Terrio is present. Senator Wilikowski is here. Senator Huggins and myself, Senator French. The purpose of today's hearing is to continue the overview and discussion of Senate Bill 64. With us is Mr. David Jones on behalf of the Department of Law. Mr. Jones, if you'd come join us and forgive me for not remembering exactly where it was we left off last Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I made a note.
Please pick up from there.
When we left off last Thursday, we were discussing Section 4 of Senate Bill 64, the governor's ethics bill. And that section related to disclosures, particularly electronic filing requirements for disclosures from legislators, legislative directors, and public members of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. We have three other disclosure improvements in the governor's bill, and these three apply to candidates and public officials in the executive branch.
Now, just excuse me, Mr. Jones, does that pertain to electronic filing, or is this on the broader topic of disclosure and the amount of information you hand over?
These three provisions include electronic filing, filing with broader disclosure of details about finances, and disclosures from former public officials. So
thank
there
you.
Are three elements to these three sections.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 5 of the governor's bill would amend Alaska law to require financial disclosures from former public officials. These would be due within 90 days of leaving service in the official positions. The requirement would apply to the governor, other high-ranking executive branch officials, to judges and other judicial officers, and to certain municipal officers, as well as some others that are listed in the definition of public official in Chapter 50 of Title 39. So essentially, this would extend the existing financial disclosure requirements to cover the final period of service of each of those that are defined as public officials in Chapter 50 of Title 39. Section 6 of Senate Bill 64, the governor's bill, would require additional detail in these financial disclosures that public officials must file. Currently, the reporting threshold is $5,000. That is, if you have income or interest that is $5,000 or more, you have to report it. Section 6 of the bill would lower that threshold to $1,000. It would also require that for all income received exceeding $1,000, the disclosures describe the source of the income, the amount received, the number of hours spent to earn the income, and details regarding the services provided. And this $1,000 threshold would also apply to the existing disclosure requirements for stock holdings, trusts and similar interests, loans, loan guarantees, and indebtedness. The governor has recently become aware that the disclosure requirements in Chapter 50 of Title 39 do not apply to certain boards and commissions. Particularly those that involve quasi-independent agencies. And the governor is examining that fact, having us look at the list of those that are included under AS 39-50-200 and comparing that to the list of boards and commissions to determine which ones are excluded and perhaps come up with an amendment to the governor's bill to identify additional boards and commissions that should be subject to the financial disclosure requirements.
All right.
Section 7 of the governor's bill would require electronic filing of these financial disclosures by public officials. As is true of the other electronic filing provisions in the governor's bill, the APOC could grant an exception in extraordinary circumstances. There are four substantive
improvements to the Executive Branch Ethics Act in the governor's bill, and those appear in sections 8 through 11 of the governor's bill. The first of these substantive improvements is in section 8, and that defines an insignificant interest in a business for purposes of the Executive Branch Ethics Act. It would establish a presumption that stock ownership or other ownership interest in a business is insignificant if the value of the interest is less than $5,000. This is a matter that was also addressed in Senate Bill 19 in a somewhat different manner. Why did we choose a presumption of insignificance? Because we want to be able to deal with a situation where an interest is currently worth somewhat less than $5,000, but the official action that the executive branch member is taking has the potential to increase that value substantially. So, for example, if I have an interest in a business that's currently worth $1,000 and I could take official action that would increase that value to $1 million, we don't want to give free rein to me in that situation to go ahead and take official action. If we establish a black letter rule that $5,000 or below is insignificant, then it would tie our hands to deal with that type of situation, because we would have said, okay, if it's below $5,000, it's insignificant, you're free to do whatever you want. But we don't think it would serve the public interest to allow that in the type of situation where my official action could substantially increase the value of my existing interest, even though now it's less than $5,000. The way that would work is that if an executive branch official had an interest that was worth less than $5,000, wanted to take official action in a matter that would affect it, that person would have to go to the designated ethics supervisor, who might consult the attorney general depending on the difficulty of the question, and get a determination as to whether it'd be okay to go ahead and take action. And if I were in a position where I had an interest less than $5,000 and my action would increase it to $1 million, I'm fairly certain a designated ethics supervisor would say, I'm sorry, Dave, you're not going to be able to take action on that matter.
Mr. Chairman, so where, what section is that spelled out in now?
That's in Section 8, Senator Duterio, through the chair. Okay. Section 8 of the bill reads, stock or other ownership in a business is presumed to be insignificant if the value of the stock or other ownership interest is less than $5,000. And rather than say stock or ownership interest is insignificant, we've chosen the words presumed to be insignificant to address the situation that I described.
I seem to recall either you or someone else making the point with respect to that provision also that it would cover the situation where a stock might be bumping or fluctuating over and then underneath the $5,000 limit. You know, if you own 100 shares of stock and some days it's worth 48 and other days it's worth 52, you know, some days it's worth over the limit, some days it's worth less. But if you phrase it in the terms of a presumption, then you're covered either way.
Or absolutely,
you could be covered either way.
That's correct.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 9 of the bill would also establish a presumption. In this case, a presumption that all gifts from a lobbyist to a public officer or to a public officer's immediate family member are improper unless the lobbyist is an immediate family member of the person receiving the gift. So we wanted to allow an exception where a lobbyist is giving a gift to an immediate family member, even if that immediate family member is a member of the executive branch. The reason we chose a presumption is, again, to give us the flexibility to deal with varying circumstances. We live in a very small state in terms of numbers of people. And there may be, for example, neighbors that are lobbyists. And if your neighbor is a lobbyist and you're getting married, you've been an administrative clerk with the executive branch for many years, known the lobbyist for many years, then the lobbyist wants to give you a wedding gift. You, in your position as an administrative clerk, have no ability to take action that affects the lobbyist's interests, it would seem overreaching to prohibit a gift in that circumstance. And therefore, we would allow, by using a presumption, a designated ethics supervisor to determine that under those circumstances, there is nothing improper about the gift. That is, that no reasonable person could infer that the gift was intended to influence the administrative clerk's performance of official duties. But again, because it's a presumption, the administrative clerk would have to go to his or her designated ethics supervisor and get a determination that the gift was permissible before accepting the gift, because there is a presumption that all gifts from the lobbyist, other than those to immediate family members, are prohibited.
I have a couple questions on this section, Mr. Jones. What's the volume of gifts currently? How many gifts are being reported now between lobbyists? And again, we're dealing with the executive branch here, so we'll just stick on that and not talk about legislators right at the moment. We may address that later. But for the time being, let's talk about the executive branch. How many gifts are coming from lobbyists to members of the executive branch?
Mr. Chairman, I have no idea. Those gifts would be reported only if they exceed $250, $150 to executive branch members.
And that volume is reported somewhere.
That's correct. Don't
have the...
And they're reported to the individual department designated ethics supervisors and not to the Department of Law unless the gifts are given to members of the Department of Law. And during my service as the ethics attorney for the Department of Law, I was aware of no gifts that were given to members of that department by lobbyists.
And the restriction on gifts to executive branch employees, is it strictly a prohibition from lobbyists, or is it a blanket prohibition? That is, if the president of BP wants to distribute gifts to the folks at the Department of Revenue, is he or she prohibited from doing so?
Mr. Chairman, under existing law, that's true. Where it would be reasonable to infer that the gift is intended to influence official action. So that's the existing law. And they're required to be reported if they exceed $150 in value. All that the governor's bill does is to establish an additional presumption that gifts from lobbyists are intended to influence the performance of official duties.
I mean, just one more question. Doesn't this then really just amount to an outright ban? I mean, if every gift is presumed to be intended to influence the performance of official duties, why in the world would we tolerate that practice?
Mr. Chairman, it isn't quite an outright ban for two reasons. One, there's the explicit exception for gifts to immediate family members. Two, because we've established a presumption, we're able to deal with the situation of the neighbor lobbyist, where the person receiving the gift is a member of the executive branch but really has no opportunity to influence anything that affects the lobbyist's interests. So it's close to an outright ban, but not quite.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
So, as I read this, no public officer may receive meals or drinks from a lobbyist. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And what is the current law on that?
The current law, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, is that where beverages and other hospitality are provided at someone's home, that's presumed not to be intended to influence official action. However,
can I interject there? When you say someone's home, you mean any private home? This can take place, or is it the home of the recipient, or the home of the giver, or is it just the private home exception?
Mr. Chairman, the regulation seems to indicate that the intent is to cover the home of the person giving the gift, and not just anyone's home.
So you can't take any individual can't take an executive branch employee out to lunch, but they may entertain the executive branch employee at his or her home. Is that, am I getting it?
Well, under existing law, what is prohibited is a gift that is intended, or that would be reasonable to infer is intended, to influence official action. And then there is an explicit exception under the regulations that applies to hospitality provided at the provider's home.
Thank you.
So just to be clear, providing food and beverages under current law is not outright prohibited. What is prohibited is a gift that it would be reasonable to infer is intended to influence official action.
And just to give maybe the public that's watching or listening some scope, you know, of the seriousness of this provision, have there been cases where there were ethics complaints brought against members of the executive branch for having received lavish dinners at the home of executives or at the home of someone with an interest in legislation? Or is this just sort of a prophylactic ban, you know, a ban put in place ahead of time?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's the latter. I'm not aware of any complaints about lavish dinners being provided.
Thank you. Other questions on this section? Senator Terrio.
I want to go back to the presumption language. Whenever you have a presumption or state there's a presumption, is it just automatic that is rebuttable?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, yes.
Okay, so you don't have to say it's a rebuttable presumption, so that the individual that is, you know, the next door neighbor, been friends since college, and so can he give you a wedding gift? You would be able to go to the ethics individual in the department and make that case and get that exercise of latitude.
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, that's both the intent and my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions on this section? Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Terrio.
Back on the whole meal issue. This is specifically aimed at the lobbyist. And quite often, of course, lobbyists, their clients come into town. They can't get a meeting with you during the day, maybe invite you to lunch or early morning breakfast. And a lot of times the client's there, the lobbyist there, and the lobbyist picks up the tab for the client and the legislator. That would not be allowed under this. But what if the president...
Just a point of order. Remember, we're dealing with executive branch. So keep your hypothetical on that. It'd be easier for the public to understand. Thanks.
Because this section is in ethics or executive ethics. Okay. So if, in fact, you know, the person from the administration went to the breakfast, but the chairman of the local PTA picked it up, not the lobbyist that organized the meeting, that would be okay.
Senator Terrio, through the chair, that would be okay, assuming that the gift was a small amount. That is, there's a presumption by regulation that anything less than $50 is not intended to influence official action. And assuming, based on that regulation, that it would be unreasonable to infer that the gift was intended to influence official action. So there would not be an outright ban on the lobbyist client paying for gifts, but there would be generally a ban on lobbyists paying for the gift.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 10 of the governor's bill would amend the Executive Branch Ethics Act, particularly with respect to restrictions that apply after folks leave the executive branch. Under existing law, there's a 2-year restriction that applies to folks after they leave executive branch service. And that prevents people from working for compensation after leaving state service on a matter in which they personally and substantially were involved or took action during their state service. The effect of the governor's bill would be to eliminate an exception that exists under current law for work on legislation and regulations. And this would tighten that 2-year restriction on employment after leaving state service by extending the two-year restriction to apply also to work that people did on legislation or regulations during their state service. There's a similar provision that was adopted by the Senate Finance Committee this morning in their Senate Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 19. Section 11 of the bill would amend the Ethics Act to extend an existing one-year ban on lobbying. Under the existing ban, the governor, the lieutenant governor, and heads of principal departments in the executive branch, which are essentially the commissioners of the departments, from engaging in lobbying for 1 year after leaving service in those positions. The governor's bill would extend that one-year lobbying restriction to apply to deputy heads of departments or deputy commissioners and to folks in the office of the governor who hold policymaking positions. There's been some question about what it means when we say policymaking position. We took that phrase from the phrase in the definition section of the financial disclosure provisions for APOC. And the intent is that those folks in the governor's office who are required to file financial disclosures with APOC would also be subject to this one-year lobbying restriction after leaving service in those positions. Senate Bill 19 included a somewhat similar provision in it. Now, the final three sections of the governor's bill are procedural, dealing with applicability and effective dates. Section 12 of the bill would limit application of the post-state employment restrictions, the one that amends the two-year restriction and the one that amends the one-year lobbying restriction, so that those would apply only to people who leave the executive branch after the effective date of this bill. The reason for that is to avoid violating the contract clause of the Alaska Constitution, because there may be some folks who have already left state employment in the executive branch and have contracts to provide lobbying services or some other service that would be prohibited under the new law. Section 13 would make the electronic filing provisions effective on July 1 of 2007, and Section 14 would make the remainder of the bill effective immediately. And I'd be happy to take any questions that the committee has.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. If we could turn back to, I'd like to talk about electronic filing for a little bit. And I think the heart of that proposal is there in Section 4, page 3. Could you outline for us the individuals to whom this would apply? And I guess I mean, would it apply not only to the governor and lieutenant governor and to Senate and House races, but also to municipal races, assembly, school board, borough positions, and so forth?
Mr. Chairman, Section 4 would apply only to legislators, legislative directors, and public members of the select committee. Section 1, which also includes an electronic filing requirement, would apply to campaign groups, political parties, and candidates for state elective office. Section 7 would apply to public officials, including members of the executive branch, the governor and lieutenant governor. And it would not apply to all members of the executive branch, just those that are required currently to file financial disclosures with the APOC. In addition, under the definition of public official in the APOC disclosure statutes, this would apply to judicial officers, including judges and justices, and to certain elected municipal officials, assemblymen, and so forth.
Would it also apply? And so, would it also apply to school board members?
I'm going to have to check our definition of public officials. That's correct, Mr. Chairman. It would apply to a borough or city mayor, borough assemblyman, city councilman, school board member, elected utility board member, city or borough manager, members of a city or borough planning or zoning commission within a home rule or general law city or borough or a unified municipality.
So it would also apply to city councils?
Correct.
Are there any elected bodies to which you, in the state to which it would not apply? That is, you know, any form of organized government to which it would not apply?
None come to mind.
Just let me make a correction to the record while we're at this point. We and the members of the committee should have this letter from, I believe it's from Tammy Kempton, who testified last Thursday about some of these provisions. She indicated when she testified that it was her belief that about 50% of the people that were filing electronically. And she went back and actually checked her numbers and discovered when she actually did the percentage that it was far smaller than that, that the actual number of candidates who filed electronically during the last election cycle was 78 filers out of 511, or 15% of the candidates. So a rather small number are actually filing electronically. So I think it's just important to keep the record straight on that and to keep in mind as we have this bill in front of us that we're imposing a fairly significant new requirement on 85% of the individuals out there running for office. What has the administration considered narrowing this somewhat to statewide races to try to cut school boards, assembly people, city, town councils out? And really just focusing on the largest races, and by that I'm thinking of governor and lieutenant governor. In your deliberations on the preparation for this bill, did you do any sort of stratifying or stratification or classifying which were the least important offices and which were the most important when it comes to electronic filing?
Mr. Chairman, we did not have that sort of discussion. Our discussion focused more on the fact that this is an opportunity to allow technology to promote democracy. Technology, by using the internet and electronic filing, would allow the citizenry of Alaska to find out more about the interests of their public officials and candidates so that they could make more informed decisions about how to vote when they go to the polling booths or whether to write letters or call their legislators or other representatives. When they're concerned about a particular issue or their representative's interests in an issue. We didn't dissect it further to determine whether those same interests would apply in more localized elections with respect to assemblies and school boards and so forth. But the principle seems to be the same. The more you know about the people that are representing you, the more informed a decision you can make about whether you want them to represent you.
And I agree that's the principle that should guide us. It's just trying to find some balance between that and what's feasible to ask 85% of the folks that haven't taken advantage of this method up until now to suddenly plunge into. What about this? Scanners, there's such a thing as a scanner, right? You can take a handwritten document and scan it and put it on the web in a matter of minutes. Have you or the folks at APOC thought about investing in a scanner, and that way you can take the handwritten reports, scan them, make them into a PDF file and put them up on the web fairly swiftly through that method? Have you thought about going the scanner route?
Mr. Chairman, in our discussions of the bill, we did not discuss scanners. One disadvantage of a scanner is that you can't conduct the same sort of search for the data in a scanned document that you can when you use electronic filing and enter the information directly into a database. So it is an improvement over having to go to the APOC itself and look through a file and thousands of pages to determine what was on the report. It's somewhat more accessible that way, but it's not as accessible as an electronically filed document.
Not searchable. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Jones, in the case, as I recall, there's an exemption, right? If a certain threshold in which you do not have to report.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, I believe you're referring to the $5,000 low-budget campaign exception. That's correct.
I'm assuming, using your rationale, that it's equally important, no matter how little or how large the amount of money you get, if using your rationale, that we should know that. So I assume that at some point you would come forward and say that to remove the $5,000 threshold?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I can't speak for the governor or the legislative director on that point. However, I understand that there is currently pending a bill in which that low-budget exception is removed.
Okay. But it's not part of this bill.
Is
it
That's
the governor's
correct.
Bill? Or?
I'm sorry?
I'm not familiar. Was it the governor's bill that's doing that? Or?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, it is not.
Okay. Thank you.
And just one more question on the electronic filing. Has the Alaska Municipal League taken a position on this proposal?
To my knowledge, Mr. Chairman, it has not.
Questions from other members of the committee? Senator Wilikowski.
Are there new groups that will be required to actually file with APOC under this law, or is it the same groups just changing the method by which they file?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, the intent is that there would be no new groups, rather just addressing the method of filing.
Other questions? Senator Terrio.
I'm just curious on the campaign disclosures. In my opinion, that the proposers of the initiative that passed, that most of the debate was on this taking the $1,000 maximum down to $500 was what really captured people's attention. But also there was the rollback of language that was passed a couple of years ago that all contributions had to be disclosed, and those that were under $100 or forget what didn't have to be disclosed. You didn't have to put down the source of the money. And of course, some candidates are raising $30,000 or $40,000 a year, and now under that wording of that initiative, no disclosure, no information on where that money came from. I'm wondering if the administration considered putting that language back into the statutes as part of this bill requiring disclosure.
Senator Terrio, through the chair, we did not in our discussions address that particular issue.
Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, I agree with Senator Terrio on that, because I remember once upon a time $99 contributions were rather common. For exactly the reason you just cited. So you wouldn't report it. You didn't want to know who you were, but you wanted to support somebody for whatever reason. So I concur that's a big loophole for the information flow in particular, as you described.
But just for the folks who are at home or watching, there's no change to that law being proposed here in the governor's bill.
Mr. Chairman, there is not. The only changes we proposed with respect to campaign finance and legislative operations were disclosure requirements, and for the campaign finance, merely electronic filing.
I have one just a slightly more global question, and that deals with the difference between, maybe you can describe the different purposes. There's two sort of sets of disclosures being addressed here, Title 24 and Title 39. The Title 24 disclosures are, for example, Section 2, and if you skip on down to Section 6, that's the Title 39 disclosure. What are the different purposes of those sets of disclosures? And maybe more of interest to the members of the committee, are the dates of those disclosures aligned? That is, does a legislator who may fall under one or both of those wind up having to make disclosures on the same dates, or are they do they come at different parts of the calendar?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the purposes are the same. I believe that the dates are the same, March 15th of each year. And I believe that they cover essentially the same types of disclosures in terms of what are your finances, what are your significant interests. And the purposes, of course, are to provide information to the general public about what their elected or appointed officials have in terms of financial interests that may affect their official actions.
Then I guess the follow-up question is why would a legislator be covered sometimes by Title 24 and why sometimes covered by Title 39?
I'm not certain that legislators would be covered by Title 39, Chapter 50.
So it's strictly through 24.
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, yes.
Thanks for clearing that up. Other questions? Senator Huggins.
Mr. Jones, we had a minor discussion this morning in finance. This bill addresses people going out of service as to become lobbyists or some activity of that sort. How about people that were lobbyists prior to and are coming into state service? Is there going to be something? Do you have any concerns about that or thoughts?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, in listening to that discussion this morning, it occurred to me that we may be overreaching if we prohibit a governor or someone else from appointing someone because that someone has experience as a lobbyist. There may be folks with lobbyist experience that have very special skills to bring to a position. For example, if I were hiring a legislative liaison for a department or a governor, I would want someone with that type of experience. And that may be the type of experience that you get by lobbying. And I worry that if we tie the governor's or other appointed officials' hands too much, given the size of our state, we may restrict too stringently the pool of available people to serve the state. It seems to me that if the governor or other appointed official makes a wrong choice, a poor choice, in choosing someone who has a lobbying background or something like that, that would reflect poorly on the person and perhaps create a conflict of interest or an appearance of conflict, then the public is going to hold that person accountable through an election or public opinion messages and so forth. And from my personal perspective, that seems the better way to handle the issue as opposed to establishing a statutory prohibition for hiring someone with lobbying experience.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, that's a little off my point. My thought was not about prohibiting hiring lobbyists. It's what you hire them for and what they can do as far as what their lobbying activities were. It's not that you can't hire lobbyists. It's about what they can do once they are in a state service job in connection to whom or what they were doing as a lobbyist.
And Senator Huggins, through the chair, it seems to me the same analysis applies. If your concern is that this lobbyist was involved in a particular issue that will now appear before that person as a member of the executive branch, it's up to the appointing authority to make the decision about whether that's an appropriate appointment. Frequently, the people that are going to be chosen for executive branch positions are folks that have experience in the area. And if the governor or whoever is appointing the person is concerned that former loyalties will override that person's desire to serve the state, then the governor shouldn't, or whomever, shouldn't be appointing that person.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Terrio.
Would we, in fact, potentially run into some constitutional problems? Because what we're talking about in so much of this is, especially when we're talking about the ban on number of years before you can go from the executive into the private sector or into the lobbying, you're using that public trust that you have whenever you work for the populace, and then you're trading that out in the open job market. And I think that the courts, you know, understand that and will allow some prohibition on basically gainful employment. But I'm not sure that the court's concern or the latitude for the prohibition works the other direction. Because the other direction, you're coming from the private sector into a public trust position. You're not trading on the knowledge, expertise, necessarily, connections that you made while you're in the public trust. So do you think there would be some perhaps constitutional issues, or do you know, has there been litigation on that reverse direction and whether in fact you can put a prohibition on a person in that?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, I'm not aware of any litigation on it, but I agree that there is at least a potential for a constitutional argument to be made against that.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Section 5 talks about, and I don't think this is in the changes that you're making, but it's there, and I'm just curious about the rationale for this. It says a public official other than the governor or the lieutenant governor shall file a statement giving income sources and business interests. And I'm just wondering if there still exists a rationale to have the governor and lieutenant governor exempted from that, or if there's another provision where they're covered.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, there is a rationale, and that's because the governor and lieutenant governor file their initial disclosures as candidates for those elective offices, and they are covered by the March 15th deadline for every subsequent financial disclosure. So they're accepted from that initial requirement because they've already filed when they were candidates.
Other questions? I see members of the administration here, distinguished members of the administration, any interest in testifying on the bill or simply here to observe? Are there members, anyone else here in the audience or anyone else online who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 64. Trick question. Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. It's my intention to take the bill and prepare a CES, capturing those portions of ethics provisions which were not in SB 19 or in SB 20. Because those are provisions that we have not addressed. So it would be my intention to prepare that, as well as capturing some other suggestions that have come to us from APOC and from the Ethics Committee about cleanup that needs to be done to their statutes, and to prepare a CES along those lines for consideration by the committee, probably no earlier than next Monday. But that's what I've got in mind. I'd be interested in hearing what other members of the committee think about, particularly electronic filing, since that's going to be the meat of what's left in this bill and the CES. Senator Wilikowski.
Well, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. I electronically file it, and as I said at the last meeting, it the system, the way it's currently structured, is very, very difficult to maneuver. It's not very intuitive at all. I think there are certainly advantages to electronic filing. At the same time, I question whether we need to have this bleed down into the lower levels, the school boards and the local city races. I kind of envision a situation in the bush where I guess there's a lot of people, if they don't have computer access, I know a lot of them do. A lot of people in the bush have very high computer access, but if they don't, this will be extremely onerous for many people in smaller races, smaller candidates. So I just have some questions about that at this point.
Senator Terrio.
Thank you. As we are walking through the sections, I think the notes that I scratched down here are Section 10. There's similar language or language that's included in the Senate Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 19. Section 11, though, was that there's a similar section, but it sounded like there must be some differences between Section 11 and what appears in Senate Bill 19. So I'm just wondering if you just drop those sections out because they're covered somewhere else, but there's a difference in the way that the idea is achieved, whether we need to keep that in mind, I guess. Then on the electronic filing, I guess I, you know, I've never used the electronic filing, you know, with the dial-up service that I had at my home, which is where I run my campaigns from. I could have walked my report in quicker than using the dial-up, I'm certain. I just recently have jumped to a DSL line, but there's a lot of my district where DSL or cable modem is just not available. So I guess I do have share some of the concerns, and perhaps there would be a better way of starting slower, and we could even have a sort of a tiered system that expands over time. We could have sections that would sweep in additional races down to the lower levels over time. Ms. Kempton indicated that the system that they envision using is not like the system that's currently in place, but I've not seen it. And I don't know if APOC could run a demonstration for legislators to look at the new hardware. I know my son just recently had to fill out an application where he got a disk. He could pull up the document and just insert the data, but you couldn't save anything. So you had to do it all at once or not do it at all. And so I don't know if that's what APOC's system, how it would operate. And certainly we know that a lot of times in filling out your form, you get it all filled out, but you're missing one mailing address, or you need the number of that particular check, or so I guess I do have some questions on the level of sophistication that APOC thinks they're going to be able to jump to, and how readily is accessible, how easy to use it's going to be. So I don't know if there's time as you work on a CS to see if they could give us a demonstration or not, because I think that would perhaps help to allay some of my concerns.
Senator Huggins. Thank you, Senator Terrio.
Chair, I would be interested, this term extraordinary, what that really means. I mean, I think it's important for us to know what that is. And, you know, it's my subjective opinion that, without a doubt, if 85% of the people are not doing it, there's going to be a huge number of people that are outside compliance with, quote, mandatory electronic. And to do that, realizing that we're going to have those kind of difficulties of good people just not being able to do it for one reason or another, and then we're wrestling with what extraordinary means, that it may, just by the percentage you were looking at, the Murphy factor will bite us. So I think it's one of those things that may be before its time. Is it a worthy goal? I agree with Senator Terrio, in a phase-in might be worthy of looking at.
For my purposes, I think, thank you for that, Senator Huggins. I think the PDF file may actually split the difference. I think there's a very narrow group of individuals who have a intense fascination with someone else's APOC. Typically, it's your opponent and your opponent's supporters who really want to see your APOC the day it comes out. And the PDF file would cure that. You could pull up that person's file. You could print it, and you could see who's been contributing at the last minute to your opponent's campaign. Yeah, I agree it's not searchable, but the search function could be incorporated over time as the data, as it is now, is hand-entered into the system, so that after a week or a couple of weeks, you can go and do a search for historical purposes as to who's contributing to whose campaign. But the PDF file is fairly cheap, fairly quick, and fairly easy way to get instant access, or fairly instant access, to a campaign disclosure form, which is really what the public wants. The public wants to get a hold of that form, take a look at it, and see if there's been some huge influx of cash or some shifting of alliances or allegiances or something like that. And so I'm going to be talking to the folks at APOC to see what the manpower needs would be to scan documents, make PDF files out of them, and see if that wouldn't. Because I think there is a gap when you get, particularly in a governor's race, when you get a 20-page APOC filing the day of the deadline, and it's, 100 entries per line or per page, or 50 entries per page, and it takes APOC, 4 or 5 days to manually enter that data before the public gets a chance to see what's in that filing. That's the missing gap in my view. Senator Wilikowski.
I guess just a question and a comment. Are you saying then that the people would mail in their APOC forms and then they would be scanned in by APOC, or that they would scan them in and then email that on? I guess that's number one. And number two would be, if that is done, then I think if we're talking about fairness to all, I guess so that there's instantaneous disclosure, we might want to change the receipt. Currently under APOC law, it's postmarked by the day it's due, and we may want to change it so that it is received by day it's due.
Senator Theriault.
But I'm not sure how you can guarantee that. I mean, we have mail coming from some pretty remote areas. And I, you know, sometimes you hit the truck connections right, and it's there practically the next day, and sometimes it's a week. So I don't know how you could.
Is Ms. Miles, are you still online? Brooke Miles?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Is the requirement that the report be filed and mailed by a certain day, or is the requirement that the report be actually in your hands at a certain time? Can you enlighten us as to that?
Mr. Chairman, it's a postmark.
So as long as it's postmarked by the deadline, that's presumed timely?
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Mr. Wilkowski.
If I could ask a question of Ms. Miles, how late, what can you give us some instances or examples of, and I don't know, maybe you don't have this situation, but are you receiving campaign documents sometimes after elections and or very late after the filing deadlines?
Yes, absolutely.
Is that a common occurrence, or is that just kind of an occasional occurrence?
Well, you know, there... It's fairly common. It's fairly common. Sometimes it could be done inadvertently. Sometimes it is remote places with lack of reliable mail service. Sometimes that is the issue. And sometimes, you know, when campaign documents are mailed from the East Coast with an expectation that they would get here bulk mail in 2 days, one wonders how a filer could have that expectation. But so it's all kinds of different things. But currently, it is a postmark test, and that is by regulation. I believe that regulation was adopted after a court case.
Senator Theriault.
Yeah, and the idea that, you know, it has to be received by a certain date, you have to remember, too, we have reporting windows. In the reporting window, you might have to report all of the transactions up until Friday, close of business Friday, and the report is due on Monday. Well, if I'm going to get it in the mail to make sure it's there by Monday, I might not have all the data from that reporting window. I might have to mail it on Wednesday or Thursday, so I haven't captured all the data in the reporting window. So I don't know that you can set. And it seems to me like generally there's a 2 or 3 day after the window, all the transactions up to this date, then you have 2 or 3 days to get the report all filled out, all the data collected. So you've only got that period of time before it is due, and by due meaning postmarked.
Just on this point, I think the only report where it's seriously an issue is the 7 day report before an election. That before that, there's some time for the mail to work and the time for the, you know, disclosures to get posted online for folks to see what's happening with an election. But it's typically as the election approaches that everyone's blood is up and the disclosures are coming faster. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. Ms. Miles, on people that, for one reason or another, are out of compliance in reporting, what corrective measures do you take towards them?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I didn't catch that sentence. The unmuting signal was coming through my phone.
If am out of compliance with a report, what sort of punishment or action do you take against them? Could you just give a minor menu?
Well, out of compliance, if you didn't file your report, we notify you immediately. Under our planned electronic filing system, which will only be available to those who volunteer, if if you don't take action to make it mandatory, would send an email immediately after the due date. And the old-fashioned way, staff goes through documents and sends you a letter within 10 days of it being due. At that point, so it's a missing report, for example. At that point, if it's a 7-day before a report, by the time you get notice that we never received it, at $50 a day, you're already up to $350 in a civil penalty. The penalties are different under campaign disclosure, lobbying, and financial disclosure, but for noncompliance, there is always a civil penalty because a report is late or missing information. If it's missing information, it's considered to be late until such time as the information is received. And Mr. Chairman, the commission staff looks at this in a somewhat fair-minded way. For example, when a candidate, for example, files a report and lists 300 contributors, X dollars amounts, as you guys are well aware, you're filing a report that's telling me, everybody, telling not me, but your constituents and the Alaskan public, all of the money that you've received from a dollar up. And you're also required to give that person's name and address. Under current guidelines, when that person has given you more than $250, you're required to give occupation and employer. So case at hand, Mr. Chairman, were we to receive a report that disclosed some 300 contributors at X dollars amount, and say three or four that might have required occupation and employer are missing, we usually try to handle with a phone call to the candidate or the candidate's chair and ask that they do their best to obtain that information and get it to us. And when that happens, cooperatively, no civil penalty is assessed. So that's in a nutshell. I hope it's helpful. If I'm not responsive, maybe we can try again.
Thank you. Ms. Miles, a couple of questions from me. When is the last comprehensive report in an election cycle due? Is it the 7-day report?
That's correct.
When I say last, I mean the one immediately preceding the election, not afterwards.
Under the current guidelines, that is correct, Mr. Chairman.
And remind me, Senator Terry was bringing up the gap, if you will, between when the reporting period closes and the time when the report is actually due. Could you remind me of those two dates?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, and Senator Terrio was actually right on. There's a 3-day period. So with the world of campaign disclosure reports, the end of the reporting period is always 3 days before the filing day.
And so the 7-day report, the report is due 7 days before the election, but is that right?
That's right. It's due on a Tuesday, and the last day that you report contributions for is the preceding Friday.
Thank you. And to your knowledge, has there been an instance when a 7-day report did not reach your office because of a delay in the mail before an election?
Yes, I'm sure there has been because of a delay in the mail, and then also there's been because the person was just a day late in mailing it. So sometimes, I have to say, Mr. Chairman, we don't always receive all of the reports on time to get them published before Election Day. We were very fortunate, and all the ones that we had received this year to have been published, but this was the first year we were able to do that as well.
And do you put on extra staff during especially election times, do you put on extra staff to help you enter data and get information up online?
Yes, we do, and I also offer overtime to existing staff who may be willing to do that. So it's a twofold thing. We get some help. The campaign disclosure reports, especially these handwritten campaign disclosure reports, I mean, I have staff looking in the phone book trying to figure out spelling of people's names. They're so horrible, really. They're badly written for the most part and very difficult to do quick data entry on. So it sometimes is helpful to have more experienced staff who've seen these names for election after election. So we do both. We get some new people and overtime for existing people.
Thank you. Other questions for Ms. Miles, Senator Terrio?
I think she was talking about me and my handwritten reports. I defy you to scan it and get any character recognition or recognition to read that data. The issue of You know, I understand Senator French's suggestion that a PDF maybe gets answers the question for those people that want immediate access to the data. But I think that really is only part of what you're trying to achieve here, Brooke. And part of it is also just efficiency in your operation, isn't it? You are putting on extra people. You are offering overtime just to enter that raw data into a usable form so it can be searchable. You can run different reports at the same time where there might be all kinds of allegations of wrongdoing that you've got to investigate too. So I want to see what you think the motivation is really for the electronic requirement. Is it just to make the data immediately available electronically out to people, or to run a more efficient operation yourself?
Thank you. Through the chair to Senator Theriault, absolutely, again, you're just exact on. The purpose is, of course, to be more responsive and technologically modern in having the information. And please try to remember, we're asking for this information not only on your campaign disclosure reports, but on the financial disclosure reports that are filed by all of the commissioners, all of the governor's assistants, that are not currently available online in any format. We've been told by the Department of Law, by the Department of Administration, that this PDF idea of scanning all these thousands and thousands of pages that come in every year for APOC into a thing is not affordable in terms of bandwidth and everything else. It's just way too much PDF information. And to have it year after year after year, which is our goal. So it's to provide better public service and also to establish efficiencies that will be long-term for this agency. Efficiencies that will be long-term because so much of this clerical and data entry will be dealt with through technology. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilikowski.
It would seem to me, I'm looking at the fiscal note, there's a zero fiscal note, but it would seem to me that there will be efficiencies and there will be a savings in overtime and in additional clerical costs. Is that correct, Ms. Miles?
That is true, and I think that it says that on the fiscal note. If you look at the narrative, I'm not sure. The I don't have a copy of it right in front of me, but I thought that I had indicated that on my fiscal note, that we would, of course, be seeking efficiencies once it's established.
My copy, just for the record, anybody listening or watching, my copy says that the last sentence in your fiscal note says, it is not anticipated that this measure will add to the costs of the Public Offices Commission, but it doesn't say anything about saving money or relieving the burdens that you operate under now.
But thank you, Mr. Chairman, but it will.
Other questions for Ms. Miles? Thank you very much, Ms. Miles. Thanks for your help.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If there's nothing else before the committee, we will stand in adjournment.